On one occasion, they even succeeded in setting fire to the houses where the Spaniards were staying. Outside the village, the chances of survival were minimal, as Cabeza de Vaca makes clear. The Indians made war on us continually, wounding the people and the horses as we went to fetch water, shooting arrows at us from the safety of the lagoons where we could not retaliate. Narvaez and his men stayed in this village for a full 25 or 26 days. They were well fed, at least. They found a large store of corn, along with mortars to grind it. Also scattered about were many deer hides and some cloth mantles of poor quality that indigenous women used as garments. And yet, despite these spoils, these weeks must have been agonizing. The painful truth was inescapable. This was no Aztec empire, and there was no gold in sight. It was an ordinary indigenous town comprised of modest houses made of branches and grass. Narvaez and his men had harbored dreams of riches kept alive by a rattle made of gold and the stories told to them by the Indians along the way. But in pursuing their goal so relentlessly, they had abandoned their ships. As the Spaniards prowled through the Indian village, the grave consequences of their actions must have dawned on them. There was plenty they did not know, and just posing the questions must have been hard. Had they been deceived by the Indian guides? Would they be able to rejoin the ships? How far could the Rio de las Palmas and the Panuco coast still be? During these weeks at the village, the trekkers mounted three reconnaissance expeditions to the surrounding areas, trying to find more substantial settlements. The return of each of these sorties must have been eagerly awaited, and the disappointment after each briefing must have been great. The land appeared to be sparsely populated and difficult to travel. Desperate, the explorers turned their attention to their hostages, including the village chief. The pressure on this man must have been enormous. Likely accustomed to being treated as a demigod, as were his ancestors before him, as these offices were hereditary, he was now being questioned and manhandled by these arrogant interlopers who had materialized out of thin air just a few days earlier. The village chief was not the sole hostage. En route to the village, the expeditioners had captured some Indian guides who were enemies of the people of Apalachee. The Spanish questioned each of these hostages separately. The fate of the expedition hinged on what these captives had to say. Remarkably, their answers, or whatever their Spanish interlocutors understood of them, amounted to a consistent but deceitful picture. They told us, each one by himself, that the largest village of that entire land was Apalachian, and that ahead there were fewer people who were much poorer than they, and that the land was poorly populated and its inhabitants widely dispersed, and that going forward there were great lagoons and dense woods and great empty and unpopulated areas. It is easy to see how the indigenous guides from farther south may have conflated the chiefdom of Apalachee with the town where they were staying. To them, Apalachee may have been an undifferentiated whole, perhaps that settlement. But the village chief knew better. No town called Apalachee existed within the chiefdom. Apalachee consisted of multiple settlements of different size and importance. Some of them were very substantial towns, including Anhaika, which likely lay to the west. Indeed, 11 years later, another Spanish expedition traveled through the area and left a startlingly different portrayal. One source described Apalachee as heavily settled and named various villages along the way before reaching Anhaika. Similarly, early 17th century witnesses gave population estimates for Apalachee ranging from 30,000 to 34,000 souls, at a time when it had been significantly reduced by military encounters with Europeans and epidemic diseases. Apalachee was hardly the sparsely populated land described by the hostages. By casting Apalachee as a small and impoverished chiefdom, the village chief cleverly discouraged the Europeans from traveling further into their territory. He was just as clever in advising the strangers on the best route to the coast. For after enduring weeks of constant guerrilla incursions and despondent about the seeming poverty of Appalachia, Narvaez's men had ceased to fantasize about gold and were now thinking only about saving themselves. They considered moving south toward the coast, where at least they would have some hope of being found by the vessels. The village chief knew well that there were other large towns on the northern portion of Appalachia's territory, along the flat ridgetops that were ideal for extensive horticulture. And if the Spaniards marched west, they would find sizable communities, plenty of maize, and eventually the capital of the chiefdom itself. In contrast, the sandy coastal plains to the south were lightly occupied and had been traditionally used mostly as a source of game and wild plant foods. Along with some of the other hostages, the ingenious chief encouraged his captors to head south by offering them a series of lies and half-truths. He said that going to the sea was a 9-day journey, and that there was a village there called Aute, and the Indians of that place had a great deal of maize, and they had beans and squash, and that because of being so close to the sea they obtained fish, and that these people were their friends. Aute probably lay outside the sphere of influence of the Appalachian chiefdom. If so, the hostage chief not only had rescued his fellow Appalachians from the destructive power of the Spaniards, but had also unleashed the scourge on an indigenous rival. The march to Aute was disastrous. After only 2 days on the trail, the trekkers ran into nearly impassable swamps so deep that the men had to wade through chest-deep waters and round submerged trees. Crossing these swamps was not only difficult but risky. As they waded through some lagoons, the men were ambushed by Indians who emerged from behind the trees on the shore and shot arrows that wounded several explorers and horses. The Indians also captured one of the guides, whom Narvaez's men had taken hostage weeks earlier. The royal treasurer must have been taken aback, just like the other explorers. But he could also not help but admire the attacker's skill. All the Indians we had seen from Florida to here are archers, and as they are of large build and go about naked, from a distance they appear to be giants. They are a people wonderfully well built, very lean and of great strength and agility. The bows they use are as thick as an arm, and 11 or 12 spans long, as tall as a man, so that they can shoot arrows at 200 paces with such great skill that they never miss their target. Two expedition members swore that they had seen 2 oak branches as thick as a man's lower leg pierced completely from one side to the other. And this is not to be wondered at, Cabeza de Vaca went on, having seen the strength and skill with which they shoot them, because I myself saw an arrow at the base of a poplar tree that had entered it to the depth of a zim, the distance between the thumb and the outstretched index finger. After 9 full days of hardships and danger, the Spanish reached Aute. They quickly learned that their exhausting journey had been for nothing. Aute offered scant relief or better prospects. It had been abandoned and burnt to the ground in advance of their arrival. Obviously, the natives were well aware of the intruders' movements and intentions. Worse still, many Spaniards became ill. Typhus or typhoid was probably the culprit. Within days of their arrival, as many as 1/3 of the expedition members were sick, Narvaez among them. The affected found it difficult to move, let alone carry their equipment. Some 40 men would never recover. The group was down to a little over 250. Aute had some maize, beans, and squash ready to be harvested, as the Appalachian Indians had reported, but the town offered no other advantages. It was still 1 day away from the coast. After considerable discussion and soul-searching, the Spaniards finally decided to push ahead to the shore, where at least they would have a slim chance of rescue. This last leg of the journey was taxing in the extreme. Every day more explorers fell ill, and the horses became insufficient to carry all of them. It was a great sorrow and pain to see the necessity and hardship in which we found ourselves, Cabeza de Vaca recalls. The men were in such a state that there were few from whom any service could have been obtained. As the trekkers traversed the last wooded swamps, their hearts were surely heavy. Dreams of gold had been dashed. Many men had already perished. The once mighty and proud expedition had been reduced to a band of survivalists lost in the New World. The coast near Aute was the expedition's final disappointment. The humbled explorers emerged somewhere between the St. Mark's River and the Apalachicola Bay, an area of shallow inlets, coves, and swamps. Although this coiled estuary ultimately reached the Gulf of Mexico, much of it is separated by a chain of barrier islands. The expeditioners must have been disconsolate when they gazed at a large, shallow bay. The water was only waist deep. At low tide, the jagged edges of the massive oyster reefs must have been visible. There was no way a ship could ever penetrate this shallow maze. After brutal marches, brushes with Indians, and bouts with debilitating illnesses, the survivors had reached a cruel dead end. For some days, they must have been overwhelmed by a sense of dejection and helplessness. I refrain here from telling this at greater length, Cabeza de Vaca wrote, because each one can imagine for himself what could happen in a land so strange and so poor and so lacking in every single thing that it seemed impossible either to be in it or to escape from it. By the time the land party regained the coast, it had been 4 months since they had separated from their fleet. The men and women aboard the ships had spent most of that time engaged in an all-out search for them. The maritime contingent numbered roughly 100 individuals, consisting of the most indispensable crew members and the 10 women. Although less risky, their activities were dangerous all the same, and filled with anxiety. The 10 women in particular faced uncertain futures, as the days went by and the prospects of never seeing their husbands again became ever more real. Narvaez had ordered the ships to go to the Rio de las Palmas, where they were to wait for the overland party to catch up. Yet a few days of sailing must have persuaded the mariners that they had been utterly mistaken in claiming that the Rio de las Palmas was near. It was very far away. In fact, they were sailing on an altogether different coast than they had originally assumed. It must have been a horrifying realization, but it was already too late to make up for their error. The crew members were the first to understand that they might never reestablish contact with the overland group. Distressing as all of this was, the men and women aboard the ships had even more pressing concerns. At the time of the separation, the maritime contingent had surrendered the lion's share of the food supplies to the land party. Within days, they must have faced severe food shortages, perhaps even starvation. Without more provisions, they would have been unable to even go back to the Caribbean islands. Only a lucky break saved them from a tragic end. Just prior to the separation of the expedition, Narvaez had sent the pilot Miruelo back to Cuba on the lead ship. He was to get additional supplies and return promptly. Somehow, this time, he was able to accomplish his mission. Miruelo rejoined his fleet after some days, bringing back badly needed victuals that sustained a search effort that would last for nearly a year. The search began right at present-day Tampa Bay. One of the vessels sailed inside the bay, where the crew noticed a cane deliberately stuck in the ground. It was split at the top and a letter perched in the cleft. The group concluded that this piece of paper contained crucial information, possibly left by Narvaez himself. The Spaniard spotted a group of Indians who were walking along the beach and called out to them to bring the piece of paper out to the ships. They refused, and instead motioned for the Spaniards to come ashore. It was a tremendously risky proposition, but the letter could hardly be ignored. Two men, an 18-year-old from Seville named Juan Ortiz, and an older man whose name is not known, got in a rowboat and made their way to the beach. The Indians seized them immediately. The older man was killed in the ensuing scuffle. Juan Ortiz survived, but was taken hostage. Apparently, the split cane and the letter constituted a trap, astutely laid out by the Indians. It appears that when Narvaez and his men rounded the bay, they had abused the Indians and had cut off the nose of a native lord called Hirihigua. This native leader had not forgotten this ignominy. When Hirihigua saw the lone Spanish vessel in the bay, he carefully set up his bait with the cunning of someone bent on revenge. The older explorer who died on the beach could count himself fortunate. Juan Ortiz was kept by the Indians for 11 years before he was rescued by another Spanish expedition. His captivity was horrendous. On feast days, the natives apparently forced Ortiz to run from sunrise to sunset on a plaza. A group of warriors watched over him. Whenever he slowed, they shot arrows at him to amuse themselves. On another occasion, the Indians tied him over a fire and released him only after he had been badly burned. According to a later writer who interviewed some explorers who knew Juan Ortiz, the poor captive had wished to die because he was forced to carry wood and water all the time and was given little food or sleep. Every day he was cruelly beaten with sticks, slapped in the face or whipped, and was subjected to other torments, especially during their days of celebration. Had he not been a Christian, he would have taken his life with his own hands. Unfortunately, we have only indirect testimonies of Ortiz's captivity. Although some of the tortures were probably real, it is also possible that Ortiz may have exaggerated his ordeal to reclaim a place among his Spanish rescuers. He would not have been the first European to feel the need to repudiate his life as a native, nor would he be the last. After leaving Tampa Bay, the ships continued to search for the land party. They scouted the interminable coast to the north, but found not even the slightest trace. The man in charge of the maritime contingent, a captain simply identified as Carvalho, had a momentous decision to make. The fleet could either venture farther north or return to the point of debarkation. Not unreasonably, Carvalho chose to go back, hoping that Narvaez and his men would also realize that the Rio de las Palmas was too far away. The ships waited at the point of debarkation for months, but the land party appeared to have vanished. Florida had swallowed each and every one of them. After a year, the growing conviction was that the land party had perished. At some point, Carvalho and his crew must have decided that Narvaez and his men had died. The 10 women, too, had begun to think of themselves as widows. Some had already established new relationships with fellow shipmates. There were more pressing concerns as well. The provisions brought by Miruela were running out. The fleet finally returned to Cuba, where some residents blamed Carvalho for being too fearful in his searches and for having forsaken the Florida coast without waiting longer for the return of their captain general and governor. Only one person had resources and interest sufficient to revive the search. Narvaez's wife, Maria de Valenzuela. She was a woman of virtue and rank, and a property owner in her own right, who did not think twice about using the courts to get her way. During Narvaez's prolonged absences, she had managed his estate as well as hers, shrewdly directing hundreds of Indians and black slaves to wash for gold, all the while raising a family. Incredibly, she decided to mount an expedition of her own to search for her husband and his men. She left her home in Bayamo and for 9 months took up residence in the port of Santiago de Cuba. She purchased 2 brigantines, assembled a crew, and secured supplies and munitions. Her determination was unshakable. The only thing she could not do was lead the expedition herself. So Maria de Valenzuela relied on one of Narvaez's associates in Spain, a man named Hernando de Ceballos. The indefatigable Maria must have instructed Ceballos to purchase provisions in Seville and take passage to Cuba, where he would take charge of the fleet. He promptly left Cuba with the two brigantines and probably retraced Narvaez's passage to Florida. But he had no more luck finding the overland explorers than had their own shipmates. Within months, he too abandoned the search and sailed to New Spain, where he sold the brigantines and pocketed the proceeds. Perhaps Ceballos misjudged Maria's character. This woman may have lost a husband and a small fortune looking for him, but her tenacity remained intact. She initiated proceedings against Ceballos to recover her money. The case reached all the way to the Council of the Indies and the Emperor. Ceballos claimed that he had spent more money searching for Narvaez than what he received by selling the brigantines. Unimpressed, the judges ordered Ceballos to be held in chains. The message was clear. No one was about to take advantage of the indomitable María de Valenzuela. María's legal victory, however, must have been a small consolation. That stubborn husband of hers, who had needlessly risked it all by going to Florida, was lost forever. Chapter 5. On Rafts. Narvaez and his men set up camp at the shallow estuary they had found and spent a month and a half there. They named it the Bay of Horses, because every third day they would kill one horse to supplement their dwindling reserves of maize, beans, and squash. It is easy to imagine the grim ritual, the decision as to which horse would be sacrificed, the killing, the river of blood that washed over the sand as the men removed the animal skin, the bonfire in which the flesh was roasted, the desperate, starving men who devoured it. The carcasses were tossed aside. 11 years later, another Spanish expedition found Narvaez's camp and recognized it by the horse skulls and the mortars that they had used to grind corn and the crosses cut into the trees. Stirrups, spurs, and crossbows, they all burned as well. In an extraordinary step, the men threw them into a hot fire and attempted to recast the hot clumps of metal into tools, mainly axes and saws. To produce enough heat to melt the metal, someone had devised a crude forge by jury-rigging a bellows out of deer hides. The pipes that drove the air out of the bellows were fashioned from hollowed-out logs. The process of melting the weapons would have been enormously difficult, but there was no other choice. The men were desperate to leave Florida. By eating their animals and melting their weapons, they were putting in place an extraordinary plan. They intended to construct 5 makeshift rafts to glide over the oyster reefs and sandbars and out into the Gulf of Mexico. Once in the open sea, they would either be spotted by the ships, or they could sail to Panuco, which they hoped and prayed would not be too far. It had not been easy to agree on this bold scheme. Narvaez had already faced a full-scale insurrection. Sometime after arriving at the Bay of Horses, the horsemen had secretly agreed to strike out on their own. They realized that they stood a much better chance of survival if they could just push ahead without being held back by the sick and the dying. Among the conspirators, however, there were many hidalgos and men of good breeding, and they could not carry out their plans without first informing Narvaez and other royal officials. As Cabeza de Vaca explains, the faction loyal to Narvaez made the conspirators understand that they would be committing a grave crime by abandoning their captain and those who were sick and without strength, and above all else, removing themselves from the service of Your Majesty. Ultimately, the horsemen agreed to stay with their less fortunate companions. The raft-building plan at the Bay of Horses was based on this pledge of unity. By killing the horses, all the men would be on the same footing, and none would be able to abandon the group. This plan had one immediate reward: access to a steady supply of meat for some weeks. It also amounted to a formidable gamble. The Spaniards were trading their most effective weapons against the Indians, horses and firearms, for 5 improvised vessels that might or might not be capable of carrying them to safety. Horses and firearms had conferred upon 16th century Spaniards an overwhelming superiority over the peoples of the New World, something the conquistadors never forgot. When Narvaez and his men disembarked in Florida, they had no idea how many Indians they would encounter, or whether these natives harbored hostile or friendly intentions. In spite of this uncertainty, Narvaez was confident that his men would prevail in just about any confrontation because of their firearms and animals. Indeed, superior weapons had enabled Spanish expedition leaders to vanquish large numbers of indigenous opponents. When Hernán Cortés first reached the coast of Mexico, he had his ships grounded to prevent his men from going back, and would go on to bring down Mexico Tenochtitlan, a city of 250,000 inhabitants, with a little more than 1,000 soldiers. Similarly, in 1536 to 1537, Francisco Pizarro and some 180 Spaniards held off perhaps 100,000 indigenous attackers for more than a year in the heart of the Inca Empire. Thousands of Indians perished, but only one Spaniard died, a man who had failed to wear his helmet. Protected by their breastplates, fierce animals, and lethal weapons, conquistadors learned early on that they did not need to negotiate with the natives. In most cases, they could simply impose their will. Nor did Spaniards have to make an effort to understand the social world of the natives, or for that matter, conceive of them as anything other than potential subjects, captives, porters, guides, or slaves. Thus far, Narvaez's men had run roughshod over the natives of Florida. Expedition members had taken the Indians' food and occupied their houses with little concern for effective retaliation. Technology underpinned a sense of supreme confidence and superiority. However, such feelings began to ebb at the Bay of Horses. As the men killed their horses and melted down their crossbows, they must have been keenly aware that they were giving up their military advantages over the North American natives. From now on, they would have to face the New World fully exposed to its perils. Surviving because of superior military technology was one thing. It would be quite another to do so by wits alone. In the late summer of 1528, the beach area overlooking the Bay of Horses must have resembled a chaotic campground. Some of the men operated the forge, while others cut down trees, and yet others went on raiding expeditions to get maize. The men had occasion to prove their enormous self-reliance and astonishing ingenuity. Not for nothing had they signed up to establish European settlements in the New World. Among them, there were artisans, craftsmen, and talented builders, and their collective skills were being put to the test. Even if they had had all the necessary tools and materials, manufacturing 5 large seaworthy rafts would have been a challenge. But the stranded explorers had to build their vessels from whatever items they had happened to carry with them or could procure in the marshes of Florida. Moreover, the men at the Bay of Horses possessed only the most rudimentary knowledge of shipbuilding. All of the men with shipboard experience had stayed behind with the maritime contingent. It was probably a Portuguese carpenter named Álvaro Fernández who led the construction effort. The expedition's last hope of survival rested on his shoulders. The first challenge was to design a raft that would actually float when fully loaded. Even though some of the men had perished in Indian attacks and many more had succumbed to illness, there were still 250 expeditioners alive out of the 300 who had started out from Tampa Bay. Each of the 5 rafts would have to carry 50 men, enough water for them, a heap of corn, trinkets, clothing, and the few remaining weapons. Assuming that each passenger weighed 150 pounds on average and allowing for a modest cargo of 1.5 tons per vessel, it turns out that each raft would need to transport a minimum of 5 tons. To bear such loads, modern rafts are often made out of extremely buoyant materials such as styrofoam or polyurethane. They are also designed with air compartments or inner tubes for additional flotation. The raft builders at the Bay of Horses could not even begin to dream of such conveniences. They had to depend solely on the upward lift provided by the wood itself. Therefore, choosing the right kind of tree was crucial, as different kinds of wood provide varying levels of flotation. Some hardwoods, such as teak wood and ebony, are actually so dense that they sink in water. Narvaez and his men may have considered using the hardwood trees that grow in the Apalachicola area, such as gums, oaks, and willows. Such woods would have floated, but they would have been very difficult to cut and drag to the water's edge, and because of their high density, they would have been unable to carry much freight. Far more viable was the abundant supply of conifers, such as cypresses, pines, and cedars that grow in the region. Any of these species would have yielded timber of an intermediate density, quite suitable for raft building. Chopping down the wood for the rafts was a truly gargantuan undertaking. According to Cabeza de Vaca, each raft was 22 elbows in length, perhaps 33 feet. In another passage, he reveals that the rafts floated one zim from the thumb to the outstretched index finger, or about 7 inches above the water, when fully loaded. Assuming that each raft was made of wood of an intermediate density, such as pine or cedar, that it measured 33 feet per side, and that the raft protruded 7 inches above the waterline when loaded with 5 tons, it can be deduced by Archimedes's principle that each raft must have weighed a little over 15 tons. We don't know the particulars of the design, but it can best be visualized as a large platform made up of 29 logs lashed together, each of them measuring somewhat more than a foot in diameter and 33 feet in length. To build 5 such rafts, the famished trekkers would have had to cut down about 150 mature pine trees, or the equivalent amount in other species. Selecting the most appropriate trees, clearing the area around them, delivering hundreds of axe blows to each trunk, and running away from the falling giants must have been hard enough. And yet felling the trees was merely the beginning of the process. They still had to remove all the limbs, cut the trunks to the desired length, and drag the logs to the launching area. Even with properly manufactured tools, these tasks would have been overwhelming. Narvaez's men had to do all this with crude axes and saws, racing against time as they consumed their last few horses. In order to ensure that all the members of the expedition shared in this brutal and exhausting labor, the leaders proclaimed that only those who worked would have access to horse meat. Once the logs had been gathered at the water's edge, the raft builders needed to devise a system to fasten them together firmly. But the group had no rope with them, so they had to make it themselves. They improvised once again by using the tough hair of the dead horses. Some members of the expedition must have spent countless hours gathering all the tails and manes of the dead horses, braiding the strands together into short sections of rope, and then tying the sections to one another. Even with 30 horses or so, rope must have been at a premium, since it was needed not only for lashing logs, but also for rigging the sails. To a group of landlubbers, for most of the men, the voyage across the Atlantic was probably their first shipboard experience, it must have been alarming to realize that an undulating carpet of logs would be the only thing between themselves and the swallowing sea. The water would be visible through the gaps between the logs. The expedition members, many of whom could not swim, were so troubled by this prospect that they set out to fill the gaps. They gathered a great quantity of palmetto leaves, mashing them into a fibrous paste that was used as oakum to wedge between the logs. A Greek Christian named Doroteo Teodoro took this procedure one step further by collecting a certain pitch extracted from some pine trees to use as caulking. Of course, sealing the bottom of a raft contributes nothing to its seaworthiness. If anything, these materials added more weight. But for some of the men, at least, it must have been reassuring. A more relevant problem was how to make these 15-ton platforms navigate without spinning capriciously and drifting out of control. Natvius's men carved oars out of cypress wood and resigned themselves to doing a lot of rowing. But they also hoped to marshal the power of the wind to make their way out of Florida. Masts rose out of the wooden platform, flying square sails. They must have attached to the masts and spars in such a way that they could be trimmed and adjusted. Made of shirts sewn together, those sails must have been a wonder to behold. Lastly, the resourceful men at the Bay of Horses turned to matters of provisions. With no way of preserving horse meat or shellfish, they would have to depend largely on corn and perhaps some beans and squash that had been raided from nearby Indian communities. At departure, each raft must have carried a considerable amount of corn. Even so, the men probably intended to mount additional food raids along the way. Carrying an adequate supply of fresh water posed the greatest challenge for the men of the Bay of Horses. In our age of plastic bottles, it is easy to forget how hard it is to make waterproof containers. Making pots out of clay would have been the simplest solution. Such containers could have been made impermeable by baking them with fire. Historically, most agricultural societies around the world, including the native people of Appalachia, have stumbled upon this same basic solution. But it seems to have eluded the expedition members. Perhaps they found no suitable clay by the sandy coast. Instead, Narvaez's men tried a different approach. They stripped the legs of the horses and cured the hides to make leather water bags. After 5 or 6 weeks of hard work, the rafts were ready, and only one horse remained alive. The men slaughtered it and devoured what they knew would be the last meat they would taste for quite some time. Then, after dragging the rafts into the water and loading them up, 50 men piled onto each one. There was so little space on board that the men could hardly move. More alarmingly, the passengers found themselves floating barely a few inches above the waterline. The waves would wash over the men as they traveled. Narvaez commanded the lead raft. He was sailing with his inner circle and some of the strongest and healthiest men. A second raft was given to Royal Controller Alonso Enriquez and Fray Juan Suarez. It would carry the religious personnel. The third and fourth rafts were entrusted to two pairs of captains. One was assigned to Captains Tellez and Peñalosa, and the other one to Captains Alonso del Castillo and Andrés Dorantes. Presumably, these four captains would be sailing with their respective companies. The Castillo-Dorantes raft must have included Estebanico, the African slave. The fifth and final raft was to be jointly commanded by Cabeza de Vaca and the Royal Inspector, Alonso de Solís. On September 22, 1528, the Spaniards set sail. And so greatly can necessity prevail, a somewhat philosophical Cabeza de Vaca writes, that it made us risk going in this manner and placing ourselves in a sea so treacherous and without any one of us who went having any knowledge of the art of navigation. For the first 7 days of their voyage, the Spaniards were forced to negotiate a labyrinthine series of inlets and sandbars before reaching the open sea. During this time, the water was never more than waist deep. At the end of this initial passage, the men arrived at an island, possibly present-day St. Vincent Island, that was so close to the continent that the two land masses formed a strait. Beyond it lay the Gulf of Mexico. As the fleet neared the island, Cabeza de Vaca's raft drifted ahead, and from it we saw 5 canoes of Indians approaching, which they abandoned and left in our hands, seeing that we were headed for them. The Spaniards immediately appropriated the abandoned canoes. They used them as timber to add gunwales to the rafts. The rafts now had 2 spans of freeboard, and at least some of the water would be kept out. The men also spotted some Indian houses along the shore. This small fishing community must have seemed like an ideal target to the expeditioners. They went ashore and were delighted to find many mullets and dried roe, an unexpected delicacy. It was a great help for the necessity in which we found ourselves, writes Cabeza de Vaca. Once in the open sea, the improvised flotilla sailed west for a month. The rafts were making headway, perhaps faring better than anyone had expected. And for the first time since the beginning of the expedition, things appeared to be going well. The rafts hugged the coast, entering inlets and bays that were dangerously shallow. Sometimes they would run into Indian fishermen, whom Cabeza de Vaca describes as poor and wretched. After 1 month of uneventful sailing, the problems returned. The rations started to dwindle, but the raftsmen were especially tormented by their lack of fresh water. The water bags that the castaways had fashioned out of horse legs had rotted completely and were unable to hold the precious liquid. As the men floated on open rafts, exposed to the sun's full heat and drying power, they must have regretted 1,000 times their decision to carry their water in hides. Finding fresh drinking water soon became the Spaniards' overriding concern. They steered the rafts close to the coast in hopes of spotting a stream or a lake, but to no avail. Then they saw a small island that seemed empty and decided to go there. It seemed like a prudent course of action. The men anchored their rafts and reached the island just in time because a storm overtook the castaways there. The storm was so powerful that it prevented the men from leaving the island. Within the first day ashore, the expeditioners finished what little water they still had. The men must have fanned out scouting for even the most miserly brook or the muddiest spring. But the island was bone dry, and the storm, which must have carried little rain, gave no sign of abating. As dehydration overtook them, Narvaez and his men must have progressed from dryness in the mouth and a mild sense of discomfort to more dangerous symptoms. Lightheadedness, inability to sweat, shrinking of the skin, and an irrepressible urge to drink a liquid of any kind. Not surprisingly, after 5 days, they made the worst possible choice. They succumbed to the urge to drink water from the sea. And some were so careless in doing so, says Cabeza de Vaca, that suddenly 5 men died on us. Salt water actually accelerates the dehydration process. The ingested sodium binds with any surrounding water molecules, forcing the cells to give up their moisture. A sudden jolt of salt can induce seizures and brain damage. Cabeza de Vaca glosses over those dark moments. I do not think there is need to tell in detail the miseries and hardships in which we found ourselves, since considering the place where we were and the little hope we had of survival, each one can imagine a great deal of what would happen there. The Spaniard's situation could not have been bleaker. They were caught between extreme dehydration and an enraged sea. Unable to resist any longer and with the storm still raging, the unfortunate raftsmen took to the sea, entrusting their fate to God and choosing to defy the elements rather than perish from thirst. That entire day in late October or early November 1528, as the men attempted to cross the open water to the continent, their rafts were buried by the waves only to reemerge instants later. In some respects, the travelers were better able to withstand the storm on rafts than they would have been in regular boats, for no amount of water thrown aboveboard would have sunk them. Their main concern was the physical integrity of the vessels. The raft crews, weakened by the effects of severe dehydration, must have been barely able to steer. They were saved by a miraculous apparition. At sunset, the rafts finally rounded a part of the coast that entered far into the sea, and the men found great calm and refuge on the other side. Many canoes came to meet the voyagers, and the Indians who came in the canoes, Cabeza de Vaca recalls, spoke to us, and without wanting to wait for us, turned back. They were large people and well-proportioned, and they did not carry bows or arrows. The battered fleet followed the canoes until they reached some houses by the shore. Amazingly, the Indians greeted them with cooked fish and many pots of water. The castaways must have been unable to believe their good fortune. The chief of this settlement warmly invited Narvaez into his house. In exchange, the Spaniards gave out some of the maize that they still possessed, as well as some beads and bells. But the cordial relationship quickly went sour. That night, the hosts attacked their guests, assaulting the sick men who were lying on the shore. They succeeded in killing 3 expedition members. The Indians also attempted to break into the chief's house, where Narvaez was sleeping, and the governor sustained a rock wound, but was not taken. Cabeza de Vaca offers no explanation for this assault. The visitors were barely able to retreat to their rafts. In the course of that eventful night, the Indians attacked 3 times, throwing rocks and other objects. They possessed very few arrows, but even so, they forced the visitors to retreat toward the shore and wounded many of them. Even Cabeza de Vaca suffered a cut in the face. The natives would have continued on the offensive had they not been surprised by a small group of Spaniards who hid behind some bushes and charged the Indians from the rear, disbanding them. The next morning, a norther began to blow, preventing the castaways from leaving this hostile environment for at least one more day. To keep warm, they made fires. Cabeza de Vaca broke up more than 30 Indian canoes for kindling and firewood. As they waited for the weather to clear up, the Spaniards must have gathered all the clay pots lying around and filled them with water. But even thus provisioned, they would not be able to travel far. After 3 or 4 days at sea, the raftsmen had run out of fresh water once again. They were forced to enter an estuary and risk another confrontation. A canoe came within sight. The Indians aboard fearlessly approached the lead raft. Narvaez asked for water. The Indians agreed to bring it to them, but only if they were given the pots to carry it. For the Europeans, it must have been a dramatic predicament. They were desperate for drinking water, but the pots were indispensable too. Losing them would be a serious setback. Negotiations must have dragged on, the tension heightened by the party's inability to communicate except through signs. In the end, Doroteo Teodoro, the Greek Christian who had collected the pitch of the Bay of Horses, volunteered to go with the Indians in the canoe. He would take along an African slave. In return, the natives consented to leaving 2 of their own men with the Spaniards. That night, the Indians returned. The pots were still empty, and there was no sign of the Christians. From afar, the natives encouraged the men they had left with the Spaniards to throw themselves into the water. The Spaniards held the men to prevent them from escaping, and the Indians in the canoe quickly turned and rowed away. The parched Spaniards, now without their pots, remained on the rafts, brooding over the fate of the Greek man and the slave. In the morning, several canoes approached the rafts. The Indians were ill-disposed and demanded the release of their 2 companions. The governor retorted that he would release the hostages only if they brought back the 2 Christians they had carried off. The canoes surrounded the rafts and attempted to close off the mouth of the estuary, but the rafts were able to reach the open sea. And since they refused to return the Christians to us, and for this reason we would not give them the Indian hostages, Cabeza de Vaca writes, they began to hurl stones at us with slings and throw spears, feigning to shoot arrows at us, although among all of them we saw no more than 3 or 4 bows. Being in this dispute, the wind came up, and they turned back and left us. The Spaniards had to leave behind an African slave and the courageous Greek man who had gathered the pitch at the Bay of Horses to seal the bottom of the rafts. A later Spanish expedition learned that these 2 men were taken inland and subsequently killed. There is no record of what the Spanish did to their 2 Indian hostages. The next day, the castaways found all the fresh water they could ever want. They came upon the delta of a very large river. It entered the gulf like a broad, majestic avenue, carrying so much water that the raft crews were able to drink straight from the sea. They had reached the Mississippi River. Since leaving the Bay of Horses, they had navigated perhaps 370 miles. Unfortunately, Panuco still lay 620 miles away. Being able to drink water from the safety of the rafts was an unexpected blessing, but crossing the mighty river posed a formidable challenge. Its discharge was so massive that it forced the rafts away from the shore. The problem was compounded by the wind, which was at the time blowing from the land toward the sea, further pushing the makeshift vessels into the open water. The fleet was driven half a league, 1.5 miles away from the land. The raftsmen were powerless to counter these forces. It was imperative that they keep within sight of the continent. If they were pushed into the open water with no bearings to guide them, they would be lost forever. This drama lasted for 2 more days, until the men were able to pull their rafts back in toward the coast. Along the distant shore, the survivalists saw many spires of smoke, but were unable to learn anything else, since it was getting dark. The prudent men decided to wait until morning before getting any closer. Even though the water was shallow, they could not anchor the barges properly because they only had stones tied with ropes. That night, the rafts became separated. The wind must have picked up, blowing two of them into the open sea once again. When morning came, all Cabeza de Vaca could see was 2 rafts on the horizon. His oarsmen rowed in the direction of the closest one, which turned out to be Narvaez's. When the 2 vessels came within shouting distance, the governor asked the royal treasurer his opinion about what should be done. Cabeza de Vaca suggested that they should all try to sail in the direction of the 3rd raft and keep together. Narvaez replied that it could not be done because the raft was very far out to sea and he wished to return to land. By way of explanation, one of Narvaez's companions added that their main goal was to reach land because if they didn't, the people aboard would start dying of starvation. It was just a matter of time before all the rafts became separated. Cabeza de Vaca's men tried to follow the governor, rowing desperately, trying to defy currents and winds to make landfall, but the crew was exhausted. For 3 days they had been subjected to a daily ration that consisted of 1 handful of raw corn. In contrast, Narvaez's craft was somewhat lighter and carried the strongest and healthiest men, so it naturally kept running ahead. Unable to keep up the pace, Cabeza de Vaca finally asked the governor to throw him a line. He refused, saying that the men on his raft were determined to reach land that very night and could not spare their effort or time helping those on the other rafts. After hearing that, Cabeza de Vaca answered that he didn't think they would be able to keep up with the governor's raft and asked Narvaez to tell him his orders. The reply was decisive. Narvaez said that it was no longer time for some men to rule over others, but that each one should do whatever seemed best to save his life. Bent on saving himself, Narvaez had abandoned his command over the other 4 rafts. Each vessel would have to fend for itself. Cabeza de Vaca ordered his men to sail toward the 3rd raft, which amazingly was still visible. This vessel was the one commanded by Captains Tellez and Peñalosa. The 2 crews traveled together for 4 more days. They must have carried some fresh water with them. Their provisions, however, were nearly exhausted. The rations had to be cut to only 1/2 a handful of raw maize per day. By this point, the men had almost certainly lost the strength to row. Their only hope of survival was pinned on the capricious wind, and yet the elements did not cooperate. A sudden storm caught up with the 2 rafts, separating them and threatening to break them apart. Somehow, Cabeza de Vaca's raft made it through another day. Tormented by extreme hunger and drenched from the splashing of the waves, the men were all on the brink of death. Even the usually reserved Cabeza de Vaca paints a dismal picture. The people began to faint in such a manner that when the sun set, all those who came in my raft were fallen on top of one another in it, so close to death that few were conscious. Only the helmsman and Cabeza de Vaca took turns steering the raft, but the helmsman too began to falter. 2 hours into the night, Cabeza de Vaca says, the helmsman told me that I should take charge of the raft, because he was in such condition that he thought he would die that very night. Cabeza de Vaca grabbed the tiller for some hours, and after midnight went to check on the helmsman to see if he had died. To his surprise, he was feeling better and offered to steer until daybreak. Near dawn, Cabeza de Vaca heard the surf. The helmsman believed that land was near. The two men mustered enough energy to cast a lead line in the dark. The bottom was no more than 7 fathoms deep. As dawn rose, they saw land not more than 3 miles away. Cabeza de Vaca picked up an oar and began to row. Most of the men remained lying, while a handful rowed frantically toward salvation. In their desperation, the conscious men must have sailed past the wave break. By the time they tried to stop the raft, it must have been too late to save the raft from breaking apart on the beach. A large wave tossed the makeshift vessel squarely onto the sand, waking the sleeping men on impact. As Cabeza de Vaca recounts, they began to leave the raft half-walking, half-crawling, and as they came on land to some bluffs, we made a fire and toasted some of the maize that we carried, and we found rainwater, and with the heat of the fire, the men revived and began to regain strength. The royal treasurer and his men had reached an island off of what is now Texas. Miraculously, all 5 rafts reached different parts of that same coast. The raft that sailed the farthest was the one led by Captains Tellez and Peñalosa. When Cabeza de Vaca last saw this vessel somewhere west of the Mississippi River, its crew had consumed nearly all its food and was headed into a storm. They must have been unable to land for several days, drifting in the high seas and facing the very real prospect of starvation. When these men finally reached Texas, perhaps as far south as present-day Mustang or Padre Islands, they must have been a sorry lot. Quite possibly some of them had already died. It is hard to imagine how this raft crew was able to navigate some 155 miles more than Cabeza de Vaca's. Perhaps they had resorted to cannibalism to stay alive. Yet they would not perish from starvation, at least not all of them. Upon reaching land, an Indian tribe known as the Camones descended on the famished crew. The castaways were so skinny that even though they were being killed, they could not defend themselves. Not a single man survived the attack. The Camones took all the Spaniards' objects, eventually selling them to other groups. The raft remained on the spot where it landed. It lay at the shore as a final testimony of the tenacity of its crew, who had sailed 750 miles since leaving the Bay of Horses. The raft carrying the religious men and commanded by the royal controller Alonso Enriquez and Fray Juan Suarez made landfall by the mouth of the San Bernard River. Their raft had overturned and must have been beyond repair. The men decided to abandon it and continue on foot toward Spanish-controlled territory. It had been a great loss, for they had arrived at a marshy area traversed by rivers and inlets. The raft would have been tremendously useful. Without it, they had to expend precious energy and time building new vessels, quite small in all probability. Even though some men drowned along the way, they doggedly walked south for many miles, surviving on crabs and kelp. While marching south toward Panuco, this group ran into Narvaez's crew, which must have landed in the environs of present-day Matagorda Bay. The reunion of the two parties must have been joyous. Although temporarily separated, the two raft crews had already shared an unbelievable adventure and must have been avid to exchange tales of their ordeals. Above all, doubling their number and seeing familiar faces must have been immensely comforting in the midst of a completely alien land. But the chance encounter also raised troubling questions. Together, the two groups must have numbered 80, but Narvaez's raft could only carry half as many. Also, there appears to have been some tension between the leaders of the two groups. After all, Narvaez had renounced his authority over the other barges in a most public way. The two contingents had acted independently for some time. The governor now wanted to shore up his control. He felt threatened enough by the royal controller, Alonso Enriquez, to revoke his title as lieutenant governor and appoint one of his associates instead. Narvaez's arrogance proved to be his undoing. Fearful of an Indian attack, he granted himself the privilege of sleeping on his raft while the men camped on the shore. The governor was accompanied by a minimal crew, a helmsman and a page. In the event of an ambush, these three fortunate men would at least have a chance to escape. In the middle of the night, the wind picked up and became so strong that it blew the raft out to sea without anyone realizing what was happening. It must have been a cruel awakening for the three men. From the raft, they must have been able to catch a final glimpse of the immense and hostile land that Narvaez nominally ruled. The vessel carried no food or water, so the three men could not have lasted long. But there must have been some time for reflection. Against all odds, Narvaez would not die of an Indian attack or a debilitating illness. Instead, in a supreme, final irony, he spent his last hours confined to a small platform floating on the Gulf of Mexico and surrounded by the enormous adelantamiento that he had failed to conquer. The rest of the men from the two rafts continued their journey to the south under new leadership, but it was already getting too cold. After some more days of painstaking travel, they stopped and decided to spend the winter on the strange coast. Pánuco would have to wait until the spring. The band of survivalists was large enough that it could not be easily attacked. They set up camp in a wooded area with abundant water and firewood and some crabs and shellfish and braced for the harsh weather. The winter was harrowing. After depleting their meager food supply, these wretched castaways were brought